Holly, your music is very political and very personal. I wonder what some of the messages are you would like your music to communicate.
Well, every year I seem to learn something new from somebody else, and I try to integrate that into the music. So it depends on what's going on in the world and in my own life, what ends up coming through the songs. But some examples of that were when I was making film and television in the late 60s. That was my career. I was doing Broadway shows. And the anti-war movement was rising up all around me. And I was against the war. I'd been raised in a family that was a pacifist family, a family that had been very upset by the dropping of the bomb in Hiroshima, had been part of the Ban the Bomb movement, had been interested in the labor movement. So I'd been around this sort of thing. I just had been very focused on my career of going out and trying to create a life for myself as an artist. But it was very hard to integrate all of those things, right? I would go at night to stuff envelopes for Another Mother for Peace at their office, and then at daytime I was on the set. Well, people at Another Mother for Peace never knew that I sang, and people on the set never knew that I had any politics. So I thought that was just the way it was going to be all my life. But slowly I started meeting people who were integrating their art and their politics and their life and all of those things, getting closer and closer to being one thing. And I liked that. It was much less schizophrenic for me. And so I started writing songs about the war. I joined the FTA show, which stood for Free the Army. It was a thing that Jane Fonda put together to entertain GIs who, from within the military, were opposing the war. It was pretty amazing work that they were doing. They had been drafted, and they maybe didn't have the money to get the college deferments or whatever it was, and so there they were in the military, but they didn't really want to be fighting the war. So this show went out, and we performed for them, and I got a chance to be able to do skits and act and sing and dance and have it also be for something that I cared about. And the song started reflecting that, and so that's the first album that I recorded. It was called Hang in There. These were the songs that I wrote after coming back, traveling through the Pacific and learning a great deal about what was going on in that part of the world. The anti-nuke movement has affected my songs. The women's movement has affected my songs. I was one of those women who would sit around in restaurants and say, well, the women's movement's all right for those women who need it, but I don't need it. You know, I was a strong career woman. I thought that, I bought what the media was describing the women's movement as, you know.
How did that change for you?
Well, you know how the news was always talking about the bra-burning part of the women's movement, which was really, I think from what someone told me, there was once just a demonstration in New York City where there was a bonfire and women brought lots of things that symbolized their restrictions as women. Some of them were bras, some of them were kitchen pans, some of them were baby diapers, some of them were, you know, high heels. And the media picked up on the bra burning part and made sort of a joke out of it, whereas people burned draft cards as a demonstration against the war, and that was taken more seriously. So I bought into what the media was saying, that it was just a lot of women out there being ridiculous and burning their bras. And it wasn't until much later when I started meeting some of these women and saying, wait a minute, these are some of the most intelligent, aware, sensitive, creative women I have ever met. And they aren't women's libbers the way the media was putting it out, as you were some sort of strange bird. These are women from every culture, every race, every class, every religious belief, who are starting to discover their strength as women. And so that, of course, started moving into my songs. That was the next album. It was called a live album, and there were a lot of songs that I wrote about early feminist discoveries that I was making about myself, as well as women's stories, women who were telling me about their lives, and I was writing songs about it. Like, the song started out fine, Mother and Her Baby Are Traveling Along. Well, I don't have a child, but someone told me that story, and so I wrote a song about it.
People probably think that all your songs are very autobiographical.
Uh-huh, I'm sure they do, in which case they think I must have lots of children, because I've written quite a few songs about kids, but no, I like to hear stories about people's lives and then turn them into songs. That's sort of what I see my role as being. I have a talent as a lyricist, and so I try to find the details in people's lives, the little things, you know. It's the big rhetorical statements are sometimes easier to get the point across, you know. stop the war, of course, is very direct, but if you can find, that's what should be said in a speech. But in a song, what has to be found is the details about those people who started the war, those who are being victimized by the war, those who are trying to stop the war, the long-term effect of war. What are the details about that? Because that's what the listener identifies with. They go, oh, yeah, I felt that way. My best songs zero in on the details. I have some songs that are much more general, and they're good at rallies and things like that, but they're not my best poetry.
I'd like to quote something from your most recent record, which is called Imagine My Surprise. You write, "One surprise was discovering that for many, lesbianism is more than a sexual preference. For me, it opened many doors, emotional, spiritual, cultural, and political." I was wondering if you could share with us what some of those doors were.
Well, one of the things was, as I was growing up, being gay, the only reference I ever heard about gayness, whether a gay man or a lesbian, was as an insult that kids in school used to use against teachers they didn't like, and it had nothing to do with their sexuality at all. You know, we'd call somebody a faggot. We didn't know what it meant, really. You know, it was just like an insult. If that's the way we're brought up, of course, there's all these stereotypes about what gay people are like. I started meeting women who were lesbians, who were women musicians, who were really incredible musicians, and who started challenging my stereotypes of what I thought gay people were like. And so that door was opened. Anytime someone challenges an attitude, which I have learned, which is a false attitude, I feel appreciative about it. I feel like my life has been expanded as a result of their daring to say, you don't understand this part of society. That's happened for me around people of color, around disabled people, around ageism, people who are in their 70s saying, you know, don't think of me as an old person. I am just a reflection of what you are about to become, you know. And so to me, meeting these lesbian musicians and having them be so clear about their lifestyle was very wonderful to me. Now, I think that a lot of people think that when one wants to identify publicly as a lesbian, that they're somehow flaunting their sexuality. And for me, it doesn't feel like that, because what lesbianism has meant to me has more to do with learning to love myself as a woman in a society and in a culture which has put women in a secondary place, so that of course, the way I had been taught about society, men would be more desirable because women were second-class citizens, right? Even in high school, I remember seeking out the friendship of men because they were the ones that got to do all the interesting things. They were the girls went to sewing class and the boys went on field trips. So I think that in its most, in the deepest sense of what lesbianism has meant to me, has more to do with my own self-appreciation. And by virtue of doing that, I've also learned to love other women, and they've become my friends. And oftentimes it has very little to do with sexuality in terms of, you know, going to bed with somebody. It more has to do with an incredible love that I have for them, to be able to love them at their best and also at their worst, because we have sometimes had to behave like clowns and been put in strange situations by virtue of the oppression itself. You know, I mean, the image of gay people and of women in this society has been pretty bad. It's kind of hard to live with sometimes.
Performers, maybe more than anybody else, communicate a lot about themselves from the visual presentation, from like how they wear their hair, what kind of clothes they wear. Mm-hmm. Particularly if you're a singer or a musician, like
carefully watched everything you do.
Everybody's watching you, and what you do with your body is going to communicate whether you consider yourself to be primarily a sexually charged person on stage, or whether sexuality has nothing to do with the music at all, and whether you're going to be very, very like visually grand or very low key
subdued.
And nonchalant, subdued. Did your image, your way of presenting yourself on stage and on your album jackets, change after you came out?
Yeah, but they had before, and it was funny, whereas before the changes would have been identified with something else, now the changes were identified with lesbianism. I did cut my hair. I had a very short haircut, as you can see on the last album I did, and I used to have very long hair. Some of that had to do, I think, with coming out, or even more with a more development of my understanding of feminism. I wanted to get rid of everything in my life that might possibly be there because I thought it was what a woman was supposed to do. So I cut my fingernails. I stopped wearing lacy clothes and high heels. I took all my makeup off. I cut my hair. I wanted to get down to the raw of who I was, since so many people do stereotype us by our looks. I felt like for myself, I wanted to get down to how I would be in my most undefined state and then build back up from that place. My hair had become a symbol in a lot of ways. On stage, it was very long and lush, and it had sort of a wild lioness type.
I should mention that Holly has very, very beautiful red hair, but it's very blondish red.
Mm. It's what some people call strawberry blonde. I don't know how they come up with that name. But anyways, it is a very pretty color. I don't know exactly why I was lucky enough to get it. I had a great-grandfather who had a very red hair, so I was the only child who ended up with it. But it was a very impressive head of hair. It was long. It was down below the middle of my back. And on stage with the lighting, it was just this halo, you know, that was very impressive. And I remember people feeling that about Joan Baez's hair when she had that long, straight black hair. And it was then when she cut it, everybody had such a response, you know. But I felt like all that it stood for, regardless of what it was to different people, that for myself, I wanted to get up in the morning and run my fingers through my hair and have not that weight be there, you know. It was a very lightheaded feeling. And I think if I'd been more courageous, I might even have shaved my head, you know. I felt this desire to get, I don't know, it was a funny thing. I just wanted to let go of a lot of baggage is the only way I can describe it, of all kinds of things that were symbolic. And now, as I'm building back, finding clothes that I like because I like them, not because somebody thinks I should wear them. Wearing my hair the way I want to. Not wearing makeup or wearing makeup when I want to. You know, and it has to do with coming to a place where you can finally trust your own self to decide how you want to look and that you're not doing it for your boyfriend or your father or your employer. You know, that you are being who you want to be. And there are uniforms that every culture in sort of imposes on us all because we're so afraid of being liked or not liked, you know, love too much, criticize too much. It's a funny thing. And I go through those changes. I think, oh, gosh, it's become such a trauma to get up in the morning and try to get dressed. I remember in high school, you know, trying to figure out what to put on because it seemed like such a big deal, you know. It was going to define you. And I want very much to get myself out of that state of mind and start doing what I want to do because I want to. In terms of clothes and looks and things like that, you know, I think there's certain other societal things where we need, even if you don't want to wait and throw your garbage in the garbage can instead of out the window, you shouldn't throw it out the window. I mean, there's some things you need to do even if you don't want to. But in terms of people's looks, I really feel like people should do what they want to do what's comfortable.
One of the questions in amongst women who perform women's music and perform frequently or primarily for women's groups is should audiences be male and female, mm-hmm. or should the women be performing for exclusively female audiences? What's your attitude about that, Holly?
Well, see, I would love to live in a society where everything happened. You know, where we weren't restricted to one kind of thing or another. I feel like women's culture, and separate from that, even lesbian culture, Native American culture, Black culture, Chicano culture, Italian, Irish, working class, disabled people, whatever brings a group of people together because of something they have in common. And it may not be, they may not have everything in common, right? And one might have several different groups they would belong to because they were many of those things. But I would love for those people to get together in different groups and in the peacefulness of that, where you don't feel like you're having to defend some part of your life, to be able to celebrate and develop and creatively cultural reflections of that particular part of one's life. So what that means to me is that I would like to be able to go to concerts that were for lesbians only. I'd like to go to concerts for women only. I'd like to go to concerts that were clearly for people who wanted to come together and celebrate progressive politics or, you know, different things like that. And also would respect other groups wanting to get together where they didn't want white people. I wouldn't go. And I wouldn't feel threatened by it. Now, men and some women who relate to men feel very threatened by these concerts for just women or for lesbians, and they feel it's exclusive and that it's reverse discrimination. Now, to me, the difference between a concert of women getting together to try to find out who are we if we had not been taught how to be, how do we want to be from a woman-identified place, I feel like I need to be with just women to do that. And I would like to see men and women who are opposed to that instead understand the healingness of it, the creativity that's coming out of it, the need for it, the fact that us being more comfortable with ourselves will in the long run benefit society at large. Whereas a group of upper middle class white lawyers, men, who have an athletic club where they don't allow women is discriminatory because at that club they do business around law. And a woman lawyer who doesn't have access to that information has her career substantially limited because she's not allowed into that in club, and it makes it very difficult. Now that to me is discrimination. Whereas if men got together, for example, they wanted to have a men's consciousness raising group and get together and talk about what were the things that taught us to be macho, that make us oppress women, that make us feel these negative things about women. If they wanted to get together to do that, which I think is a healing and creative meeting, and said it would be better for us not to have women there for that, I would think that was fine. I wouldn't think that was discriminatory at all, you see. So it's hard then when you come up try to write a law about discrimination, because the law doesn't define the fact that some gatherings of an exclusive nature are creative and healing and positive, and some are very negative and destructive.
Has it been possible for you to keep the different kinds of audiences and the different types of settings that you seek?
Well, I think that women's concerts get a lot of criticism, and that that some men and women have argued with the producers and the artists who've wanted to do that, and it's drained a lot of energy from women. Energy that they could have been putting into doing something more constructive. In some cities where the tradition of a woman's concert has been going on for a while, the general public has started to be educated about it. And some people resent it and some don't, but they usually don't bother it. But I think there's still a lot of people who, let's say a man who is developing a feminist consciousness, and he feels because he is supportive of women and supportive of lesbian lifestyles that he would like to come to the concert. But he needs to understand that his support is absolutely necessary, and that part of that support is to let us have some time by ourselves, and that we will also do concerts that are for mixed audiences, and then he can come to that and support that, and we'll be welcome there, you know.
What do you think, Holly, some of the main questions are that face women now who perform women's music? Because I think the women's music movement has grown, and it's changed through growth, and probably faces a lot of important questions that it's going to have to resolve.
It's hard. I think economics is the biggest one right now. That's not news to anybody, is it, for any field? Economics, it's a really hard time for people with money, people without money. Recording an album, for example, if you want to make an album that is anywhere near the technical quality of that which is coming out from the industry, you can spend easily between $30,000 and $90,000 on it. Now, women have put out albums for $7,000 and $10,000, and I think they've been amazingly good. They have no money for promotion. They don't buy ads in the major newspapers. Word of mouth is how their records get sold. But there's some albums, like Robin Flower just put out an album where she had women like Nancy Vogel and a variety of really fine musicians working on it. And it's got some really good time bluegrass music on it and some nice, Robin's a fine guitar player. Well, the folk world is not going to know this album came out, really. I mean, she's been doing real well within the community that is familiar with her. But because we don't have the kind of money to promote the album, I don't feel we need to jam it down anybody's throat, but we don't even have ways to let everybody know that it exists. And I know there's a lot of people who would like to hear this music. Her record was sent up to the Vancouver Folk Festival, and all of the people up there loved it. And the man who runs the festival played it for a lot of people without telling them it was a woman. He was just sort of doing an experiment. And of course, people assumed that she was a man and loved her playing. And then when they found out she was a woman, they had this traditional response of, oh, a woman did that, you know. But how we let people know about this very fine music is, I think, is one of our biggest problems.
You started a record label. Mm-hmm. And are now co-owner of the record label. And you've produced albums of your own, albums by Sweet Honey and the Rock. Refresh my memory about some of the other groups have you recorded.
Those are the two, yeah. Mainly the record company. It's Redwood Records. It's my own. I started it and I owned it. I did it mainly because I wanted to put those anti-war songs I was telling you about earlier on a record. I didn't plan to have a record company, but I also didn't want to wait at that time, this was in 1973, for, you know, Columbia Records or something like that to get political enough that they would want to put out an anti-war album. I would probably still be sitting there waiting for a record deal. So I decided to do it myself. It was very low budget. We did it for $7,000 in a little basement studio. But the response to it was so exciting that it led me to do more. I was working with the pianist and arranger Jeff Langley at the time, and we did three more albums, or three including that one, the live album, the anti-war album, and then one called You Can Know All I Am, which we did in a studio with some very fine musicians, some of which have become very famous since then. Lee Ritenour played on one of the songs. But and then the fourth album was done with all women. It was called Imagine My Surprise. And I like the business part. I like to run business things.
No, I wasn't
like
sure how you'd feel about that, because it takes away a lot of energy from performing, I'm sure.
Well, that's what I'm finding, and so I think I'm going to go back to not being so involved in it. But I like knowing how things get made. You know, I don't like being the protected artist who's sitting up on a cloud just creating, right? Because it's not like that. I want to be part of the whole process. So now I've sold 2/3 of the business to two other women, and we're a partnership now. And they take care of most of they book my tours, and they take care of all the money problems and distribution and, you know, the whole business thing. And yet I meet with them on a regular basis, and they update me on what's going on, and we make group decisions. Like, they present the facts, and then I have a vote, and we do everything on consensus. But I'm not as day-to-day involved in it as I was before. And that's a relief to me, because it's getting so that I really could use having all my time free to do writing and music. Like, I would love to have the time to do films again and television again. I would love to think about the possibilities of being in a Broadway show again. I mean, I think there's a lot of styles of music and forms of music that I am excited by, and I can't really even get to those if I'm putting time into the business part of it.
Well, I wish you a lot of good luck with whatever you decide to do in the future. Holly, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been writing biographical novels and biographies for many, many years, since what, the mid-1930s?
Well, yes. I wrote the manuscript of Lust for Life, the Vincent van Gogh story, in 1930 and 31. It wasn't published until 1934.
What has attracted you to the form of the biographical novel?
Well, let me make a distinction. The biography has three persons involved. There's the author, the hero or heroine, and the reader. They go down parallel tracks, but those tracks rarely meet or intermesh. In the biographical novel, there's only one person involved, because I spend at least 2.5 years of research and 2.5 years of writing so that I can get inside the brain and the heart and the breast and the blood and the bone of my hero or heroine. So I become the person I'm writing about, and the purpose is that by the time you get down to the bottom of page one, you forget your name and that you live in Philadelphia and the year of 1980, and you become Charles Darwin or Vincent van Gogh or Mary Todd Lincoln or Dr. Sigmund Freud. So we're only one person. We're all three one person, and you live that life emotionally so that you never forget it, and it enriches you forever.
I know I've asked some actors if they've ever felt that they've become the character who they're playing in a play, and many of them have said to me, no, I mean, I'm not insane, I'm not losing my mind or the ability to distinguish who's who, I'm just an actor, it's my art and not my personality that on the stage.
That's not always true. You may remember that Henry Fonda played my Clarence Darrow on the stage and on TV about 2 years ago. He came up to our house to have, I think, drinks or dinner with us and ask us about all of the developments and what we thought about Darrow now, and he has become one of our great folk heroes. After about an hour, he got up from the table in the library, turned his back on us, hunched his shoulders, mussed his hair, and turned around in 30 seconds, and there stood Clarence Darrow. Miracle. Absolute miracle.
But now, when you become the person that you're writing about, what do you mean there? To what extent do you try to be? To what extent are you capable, no matter where you live, of really becoming that person or of really understanding their motivations and what went through their mind?
I've spent my whole life doing it. That's my trade, my art, and my craft. First of all, I gather all of the letters. In the case of Charles Darwin, in my new book, The Origin, there must be about 20,000 letters to him and from him. You see, they had no telephone, and they had no Western Union, so they wrote every day. Darwin must have written an average of 7 or 8 letters a day to his family, his fellow scientists, his friends all over the world. You read these letters, and you begin to hear their unconscious mind working. For example, we all talk to ourselves, true? When we're alone, there's an interior monologue. That interior monologue corresponds very closely, not exactly, but closely, to what we write in letters. And so as I read these letters, and as I read the diaries and the journals, and I read other people's letters and books, and one of them will say, I saw Darwin yesterday and he told me, and then there's a whole page of what Darwin said in his exact dialogue. So slowly, slowly, as the months go by, weeks and months, and then a year or two, I lose the sense that I am Irving Stone, and I become either Clarence Darrow, or I become Vincent van Gogh, or Michelangelo in The Agony and Ecstasy, or Charles Darwin in The Origin. It's a feat, but it's a way of creating an art.
Now, if I was to read all of Darwin's letters and live on the Beagle and go in his home and do some of the things that you did for writing The Origin, I'd probably write a different book than you would.
Yes, of course you would, because your personality and your background and education are different from mine. But if you read all the letters, diaries, and journals, you would write an authentic Charles Darwin. You would have to, because you would have all of the accurate material you needed to do it.
Why did you choose Darwin as the subject of your most recent book?
Well, as you know, I come out of an academic life. I spent 7 years at the university, and I taught for 3 years at the University of California at Berkeley. During those years, I read very widely across the face of literature, and I came to the conclusion that there are 4 men, I'm sorry that there isn't a woman among them, but it happens that there isn't, who have created our modern world and our modern mind, your mind and my mind and everyone listening now. Not in the order of their importance, because I don't know anyone who could rate them. They are Einstein, who created our whole space age, Karl Marx, who created the communism that occupies all of the USSR and China, not his communism, their own, but occupies almost half of the world. Then there's Sigmund Freud, who discovered and charted the unconscious mind so that we're now able to understand all of our own motivations and act according to our best interests instead of our worst interests. But the most interesting of all for me is Charles Darwin, because he turned the world around. When he came home from the Beagle in 1837, after 5 years of collecting and geologizing and thinking about the origins of these thousands of species and varieties that he had seen, he released us from chains. We were enslaved, actually. John Henslow, who was his mentor at Cambridge University, said, I would rather die than see any one of the 37 articles of the Church of England changed. Well, Darwin changed practically all of them in our minds. He freed us to think as we want. He never said there isn't a God. He interpreted God as laws, G-O-D-L-A-W. God created universal laws which are still working. There are a few accidents. God didn't create mice to be eaten by cats. God didn't create worms to eat the intestines of certain animals. These are accidents. But by and large, God's universal law is still in existence, and that's what Darwin set out to prove in all of his books, and I think he did prove it.
In many of your biographies, you've taken great men who have made great contributions, Darwin and the theory of the evolution of the species. You've written about Michelangelo. You've written about Vincent van Gogh, about Clarence Darrow. What type of sense do you want to give about the process of discovery that these people have gone through and coming upon their art or their philosophies?
You're asking what is the common thread?
If there is one.
Yes, there is certainly. Over my desk at home, I have a placard in wood, carved in wood, which says, "Man, comma, against obstacles, comma, for man." I pick an individual, many of them unknown. Vincent van Gogh was unknown in this country in 1930-31. It took me 3 years to sell my manuscript. When my book on Clarence Darrow came out, not one newspaper in New York would review it. They said he's a clown, he's a hoodlum, he straps his galluses in court. Now he's a great national hero, you know? So the common thread is that these people, men and women alike, sometime in their lives, young, middle-aged, or old, have a dream or a vision of something they want to accomplish, not for themselves, but to make this world a little more intelligible, a little more orderly, and a little more beautiful. They start, they get beaten over the head, they get knocked down, they get kicked, but they always rise, and they continue the struggle, and they continue their creativity, and at the end of their lives, they have contributed a little something of that vision or dream that they had some years before.
Some artists have been very self-destructive and have had really, not all of them, but some of them, some great people have had really messed up personal lives or a little touch of madness. How do you deal with that when you are writing about such a person?
Well, I try to deal with it honestly, including faults. For example, when I finished one of the books, one of the chapters on Darwin, and Mrs. Stone had edited it, and we were going to about fifth or sixth draft, because we don't go to the printer until we have a seventh totally polished draft. I gave her the chapter, and I decided it was finished. And then about a month later, reading a very obscure monograph, I came across a fact that showed that Darwin had been wrong in some one aspect where I had him right in my chapter. And I said to myself, well, I've been at this 3.5 years, and I just stumbled across this by accident. No one else is ever going to know, so why should I bother with it? So I stayed awake all night long, and the next morning I took that chapter back and I rewrote the pages and admitted the fault because I had to. If you're not honest, your book is going to be no good. No one will be convinced. No one will sympathize with your hero or heroine.
Who do you think your readers are? I know there are many people. Do you know who your readers are?
Yes, I think we do. We found out with Lust for Life. There are certain areas in American life where the IQ is so low that they don't want to read a book. We have millions of book readers. When they say that television is, you know, destroying books, not true. We're selling more books every year in America, and more people are reading them. We have readers all the way from mailmen, truck drivers, housewives, on up to university presidents, scientists, all over the world. In my home, in Beverly Hills, in the library, one wall is called the Stone Wall, capital S, capital W. There are 800 volumes there in 80 languages of all of my books. There is every language where they have a printing press. So we assume the students love them. Now we get our mail from grammar school students as well as high school and college, and we have a large portion of the reading public.
Two of your books that I know of, Lust for Life and The Agony and the Ecstasy, have been made into movies. Were you satisfied with the film versions?
Well, an author is rarely satisfied because the studios say, once we bought your book, you have nothing more to tell us or teach us, so they lock you out of the studio while they make the picture. Lust for Life was brilliantly made. The pictures from all over the world were wonderfully done. They failed to introduce in the very beginning and carry it on to the end the brother-love relationship between Vincent and Theo. When I saw the rough cut at MGM, I said, what happened to the brother-love story? You can't go on without that. So Dori Shary, who died just a few weeks ago, then president of MGM, said, you're absolutely right. So he cabled the man, Englishman, who played Theo, brought him over and had somebody in the studio write 7 scenes, which they put in like sliced bologna in a sandwich. But it was a good picture. The Agony and the Ecstasy, unfortunately, that's a very big book, and Michelangelo's life is very long. The book, the picture, concentrated only on the painting of the Sistine Vault, which was 4 years of Michelangelo's life. And while I watched it, I kept saying, hey, remember Michelangelo's the greatest marble carver the world's ever had, the Moses, the David, the Pietà, and all that was left out. So, of course, we felt that there could be another 2 or 3 movies very easily.
Would you like to see any of your other books made into movies?
Yes, for the good reason that I'm a book maniac. I love books. I write them. I read them. I love people who read them and write them. We found that when a movie came out and was circulated all over the world, as movies are, many of the countries in which our books had not been translated then translated the books and been in publication ever since. Yes, I think that the Charles Darwin book, The Origin, won't make a movie because you cannot get that life into 2 hours or even three. A 12-hour series on television will give us the whole book and that whole great love story of Emma Wedgwood Darwin and Charles Darwin and the magnificent discoveries he made and the way he turned the world around.
Irving Stone, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure, I assure you.
That was